This is the Saxo Market Call, daily insights on what is moving the financial markets.
Hello and welcome to the Saxo Market Call. It is Tuesday, 4th of October, 2022. Markets certainly in a brighter mood this morning than where they were yesterday. We'll get to that, of course, in a moment. For now, though, we need to highlight, as you can see on slide two, and do find the link in the podcast description. Our Q4 outlook has dropped and is out this morning, and you can have a look at that. We have, looks like, around 70 pages for your entertainment there on just about all asset classes. We even have some thoughts on crypto in the outlook. The theme is winter is coming. Pretty obvious that that has been the this is the case in Q4. Winter does come every year in Q4, but it's all about, of course, in part, the energy crisis and how Europe in particular is going to get through this. But I think there's plenty to look through in this outlook, many things to chew on. The key, I think, takeaway or key idea and thing we would put forward from it is the idea that we're probably going to reach peak tightness in the coming quarter. We actually are in Q4 as of Monday here of this week. In other words, the market will finally get to where the Fed is going to peak out sometime next year, and maybe even at some point the Fed will have to roll back QT plans. So, you know, and I think that's kind of what you're seeing in the markets yesterday and today, this idea that this sort of desperation to sniff out the Fed pivot. Is it here? Is it here? There was a weak ISM manufacturing. Yields are dropping in the 10-year, 10 basis points, 20 basis points. Let's all celebrate the coming Fed pivot and the great easing to come. We do have to remember, Peter, that with that easing is a recession, and that'll be recessionary profits for equities. So it's, of course, you got to get things, your ducks all lined up in the right order here. And there may be a celebration of liquidity implications of central banks eventually pivoting. And I think I'm not sure that this is the pivot just yet, but that we have to remember that the reason they pivot is a very bad one. So in that context, let's have a look at yesterday's session and some of the interesting things we discussed on the internal market call that you pulled out of what was going on.
Yeah, so I agree with you. It's actually along the lines that we talked about yesterday, John, in a different conversation, that we can have this short-term rally if we sense that the Fed might slow down their aggressiveness or their pace of policy change. But I very much think that they have set in motion a sequence of events in the future that will lead to a dramatic slowdown in earnings per share. So just like a lot of people are questioning whether, okay, our equity is actually getting cheap now if you look at forward price earnings multiples. And my answer would be, well, it depends where earnings are going. And I think we have stacked up or we had set ourselves on a path where these earnings will take a significant hit. So regardless of what we're celebrating today, I don't think what is happening is really changing the medium outlook here for equities. But I think the most important thing or what was interesting about yesterday is that when you have a massive rebound in the equity market, typically what we have seen is high growth and high beta pockets of the equity market would respond in favor and maybe be up 5% or 4% on such an enormous day. But that was not what we saw. We had commodities and we had defense. We had a little bit of the high beta growth in payments, semiconductors rallying. But look at the e-commerce basket, only 1.2% in slide three. We have the bubble stocks, only 1.5%. And I'm jumping a little bit, John, because we need to get back to the macro story as well on this. But if you look at slide five, I've put in Tesla. So that share was down almost 9%. I've put in here, I think it's the 40-ish largest names in the S&P 500. And Tesla is the only one that is actually down more than 1% in that group. And that's because, of course, they missed on the deliveries. They're trying to spin the story that it's only about the supply logistics. And I think the investors are really second-guessing now the forward-looking estimates for growth for Tesla. So I think, and I've put in here on the slide, this is a relative index between Tesla and the global consumer discretionary index. And it had been rallying against this index since the bottom in May, which is quite odd because if things are bad for the consumer discretionary sector, you would think it's also bad for Tesla and this whole cost of living eating into disposable income. And I think maybe reality is just slowly setting in now for Tesla investors.
All right. Now, in terms of where this rally could take us without really threatening the bearish case. And the very we're getting into some oversold conditions. This very long slide here, we discussed about the risks that we're either going to really continue lower a pace or back up. Well, we're backing up. Look on slide three there, the S&P 500 future for December. There's that local resistance area around 3750, but just eyeballing it, a sort of 3800 to 3900 zone looks like a sort of a safe territory for a squeeze to back up without really altering the implications. So we start closing above 3900 and sticking, I think it starts to shift a little bit, the momentum here in a bigger way. We could also just turn around on a dime pretty soon. and I would suggest that is a higher risk that happens if the reason for yesterday's rally was in part the type of noise we saw on in the Twitterverse with Wall Street Journal Fed whisperer Nick Timmerhouse. Okay, I have to get the chain right here. I think he retweeted or tweeted an indication from Greg Mankiw, a very influential economist that was chief of economic advisors under George Bush Jr., who approved something that Paul Krugman wrote about the Fed potentially tightening too rapidly here. And then that sort of noise combined with probably a very, very short market speculatively. And then this weak ISM manufacturing print I mentioned that came in at 50.9 to 52 plus was expected, and rather concerning the new orders, a more advanced or leading component there, 47.1 versus 50.5 expected, 51.3 previously. So new orders shrinking, and the employment one below 50 once again after being quite above that the prior month and expected to continue well above 50. So that that sets up this again these hopes of a Fed pivot. I guess pushing back against that a bit would be the Fed's Williams of the New York Fed, so a voter obviously saying that we're still far away from where we need to be in terms of tightening. And then interesting, another one, Barkin, a non-voter regional Fed president, I believe out of Richmond, saying that, mentioning the dollar, I think it's the first time we've seen the dollar really anywhere in the discussion, saying it has spillover implications globally, but the Fed's focus has to remain domestic. So that was an interesting sort of pushback, if you will, on perhaps what's more important, and that is what the Fed is actually going to do rather than what the market hopes the Fed is going to do. So briefly, where was the market reaction interesting? Of course, risk sentiment thawing, but a part of the driver for that on the fundamental side was the longer end of the U.S. Treasury yield curve falling quite a bit. You see that on slide four, the 10-year benchmark there, traded below 360 basis points. It was down over 20 basis points at one point intraday. The key level there, obviously, the 3.5% prior peak back in June. And then interesting, all in your space, spot gold, so at least recovering the first little leg of a key area of resistance, the 1680 to 1700 area. We see it vaulting above 1700 spot gold, as this is exactly what gold wants, and that is lower yields and a weaker dollar. So take us through what you're seeing, and you've also, we've got some developments, I guess, partially dollar related as well, but also OPEC related in the crude oil market.
Indeed, John, and you mentioned dollar and yields, and most certainly it is what we have been looking for. And again, have we hit the peak hawkishness? That obviously only the future can tell us. But the fact that we are potentially starting to look at these weaker numbers at a time where could potentially mean that inflation is not going to be brought down to levels that the market is currently pricing in. And I think it's just worth still pointing out that the 10-year break-even yields is currently at an 18-month low around 2.2%. So basically 10-year break-even yields or break-even inflation around 2.2. At the same time, we got real yields at the highest level in 13 years. So just imagine what happens if we start to see a readjustment in inflation expectations and at a time where recession starts to bite. Basically for preventing nominal yields from moving higher, that would be a very positive scenario for gold. So so yes, we've done this first part of the work, and that first part of the work has been driven by short covering, as we highlighted in our cut update and also in the podcast yesterday. The net length in gold short, the net short jumped 25% in the week to last Tuesday, so it's now at the near 4-year high, the net short. So plenty of shorts to be covered, and that's the reason why we're seeing this initial move higher here. So now we need to find support below that 1700 level. But I think equally important was almost 9% jump we had in silver. As you can see on slide 8, we are taking out the August high. We're now taking aim at 2114. So And even the gold silver ratio is also getting close to breaking an uptrend that has been in place for at least a year. So a space very much worth keeping an eye on. And I think also we just into this whole mix, we also had to add Putin following his annexation speech last week, which but yeah, I'm not going to comment, but make your own conclusions. But we never know what's going to happen next or come out of the Kremlin next. And I think the market is also somewhat cautious about that, and that's also giving a bit to the market. And just on the oil space, we're obviously awaiting the OPEC Plus meeting tomorrow. The gains yesterday extended throughout the day. So we will most likely see a cut, but you also have to remember that a cut is not going to be a real cut in a sense that only a few of the producers currently actually have reached their quotas, so they can reduce. Can you ask Nigeria, who is still more than 1 million barrels, to suddenly start cutting? I don't think they will accept that. Russia obviously is producing below their target as well, so they're not going to cut either. So the cut is left to a handful of producers, which probably will mean that any cuts will only have in effect have something like 30 to 40% of impact on in real terms of barrels. But it's still, nevertheless, it's pushing the market higher as we speak.
All right, and you mentioned that if the big rally in metals there, especially silver, a really interesting test of the coincident indicators for something like the Australian dollar overnight. So we had the RBA out with its scheduled meeting. They hiked only 25 basis points. The market was leaning, not fully priced, but leaning for a 50 basis point move. And that smaller hike in the guidance saw 2-year rates in Australia down. I think it was down 40 basis points, if I'm not mistaken, at one point in intersession, but a huge marking lower of the RBA's hiking plans. You would think that's currency negative, but with all this focus on a huge thaw in risk sentiment and this big bump in metals prices, you saw BHP Billiton stock on a very strong session. That whole change of mood has actually seen the Aussie rising back quite sharply, well above 65 the last time I saw it this morning. So you can see that these sort of coincident indicators are far more important suddenly than something like the central bank when they come with stronger force. So very interesting reversal there also, and other Aussie crosses overnight. Of course, it's out there lurking if the sentiment shifts again to the downside, but Aussie finding support on that. And then sterling continues to find support. So Kuerteng's backtracking on the the least popular of these tax cuts, the one on the high-income earners. Ironically, the least impactful in terms of the actual impact on the budget. It's only, I think it was 2 to 3% of the actual impact of the other measures that were announced, the cancellation of tax hikes that were scheduled elsewhere. But this has just been enough, together with the Bank of England's emergency move. And then now here are these fervent hopes for a Fed pivot to drive cable towards 114 this morning. I think it's getting a bit overdone here, but let's see what happens. 115, I think, is the first really key milestone for cable. Impressively, also elsewhere in sterling, euro sterling reversing down below that 87 plus former range high, and down below 87 this morning and this morning's trade. So let's see how that move survives. But just an amazing stabilization, and what to me is not particularly a confidence-inducing political environment when this government still looks like it's on the ropes. What comes next? All these external deficit factors that are strong negative drivers for sterling are still out there. Let's see what the budget projections say next week. There'll be forecasts from the government there on what these new, and of course these have had to be recalculated in light of Truss's energy subsidies and the new tax cancellation of tax rises that were otherwise set to take place. Finally, in the FX space, with this thaw in risk sentiments, the Swiss franc is tumbling there. Perhaps that Swiss bank that's in a bit of rocky trouble here lately, seeing some of the Swiss weakness as well. And then in oil space, that silver trend reading at 7.8, just an incredible reading there. And the momentum shift is absolutely staggering over the last couple of days. Okay, picking up the pieces here, I see you've put in a financial conditions chart, Peter. This is the Chicago Fed, the one on slide six, the Chicago Fed's National Financial Conditions Index. It's a mix of factors. It is getting towards the highest levels it's been at, really on a sustained basis. We haven't seen this since way back in 2011. I mean, the debate is out there, and we kind of mentioned it. I think it was in yesterday's podcast that we believe that the Fed is more likely to break something, quote unquote, in the markets before it actually really materially breaks the economy. Further thoughts on that?
Yeah, it was actually so it was meant to be part of the initial discussion we had with the what happened yesterday and with the Ted Timmerhouse piece. But the whole point is that it's not like we have any big aspiration about Krugman and his article, but just the mere fact that you have some leading economists in the U.S. that influence and shape the thinking at the Fed and economic circles is the important signal. And the reason why I put in the financial condition index here, the adjusted one, because that's adjusted to the underlying economy, is that the question is whether we're already finding ourselves in some rather tight financial conditions, because relatively to where we came from is already tight. And that might be one of the things that the Fed is looking at. Okay, maybe if we go a little bit tighter from here, and when we can then we can go to a standstill and then see how the economy evolves with a slightly above average, at least according to history since 71, how the economy performs under those conditions. It might be sort of the next evolution, but it's a guess here. But I just wanted to put it in here, and I put in the 52 moving average, because I think sometimes also, just like when we talk about electricity prices, it is those sustained levels of a given thing that typically have an impact. And if you look at the 52 moving average, it's now higher than it was during the pandemic, and also in the weakness at the end of 2016. But it still hasn't taken out the 52 moving average high that we had during the euro crisis in the summer of 2012, when Mario Draghi said that he would do everything it would take to get things under control.
All right. And then on slide 9 in your earnings watch, we talked a bit about Biogen yesterday, but this is an interesting chart you put up here. Isn't this often the case? These quarterly earnings per share, they start off at one level and they often get revised lower. Or is that not the case? The revisions tend to be random.
I think the pattern is more that now that we are in the late phase, I think this is more the typical thing that you see, that you have a certain level of expectations, and then as a quarter progresses, those expectations come down. I just wanted to put it in here so everyone is sort of aligned of with it, what those expectations are, or how they have changed at least going into the earnings season that starts next week. So we're down 7% in those quarterly earnings per share figures for the Q3 earnings season. And I think it tells you the story. And I don't think the 7% is enough. I've said that yesterday. We've talked about the earnings season and how it seems to us that at least that analysts are really behind the curve, factoring in what is happening and with the price signals that are coming out of financial markets. It's going to be a super interesting earnings season. But and we talked about Biogen. I won't repeat myself, so you can listen to yesterday's podcast and go to the end if you want to have some takes on Biogen, but they're reporting today.
All right, let's go to the macro calendar on slide 10. We have an RBNZ meeting up tonight. That'll be key for that currency. I noticed the Aussie Kiwi rate after the RBA's big downshift in guidance and the 25 basis point move tried to sell off. And then at least as I was before I came in to record the podcast, was really just kind of halted in its tracks. Didn't exactly rise back higher, but just that mismatch and the huge downshift in Australian rate expectations versus the market reaction because of other factors, commodities, et cetera, just shows where we are with this market. So watch the RBNZ. The guidance will be important there. It's been one of the most beleaguered currencies for the cycle. So if we are continuing this squeeze on all things risk sentiment, we could see a Kiwi certainly stronger in the crosses. Otherwise, I'm not sure we get the big pushback on anything specifically from today's developments. We do have couple of Fed voters speaking. Williams, once again, I think the context there was not something you would look for policy. Hence, Fed's Mester also out speaking, but really it's about tomorrow's ISM services. If that's a really big mismatch with ISM manufacturing, it's a far more important part of the U.S. economy anyway. So I think that carries far more weight than the ISM manufacturing, where as well we have this whole risk that we're just seeing a downshift for a while because the big bullwhip effect of overstimulus and then an overresponse to the excessive demand. And now this consumption has switched more to services anyway, that the manufacturer may be giving a sort of a distorted picture of what's going on here. Regardless, there's that one. And then we have, of course, the Friday jobs and earnings data. The big pushback, again, against the whole Fed pivot idea would be strong data points, especially on the ISM services and on the earnings side, assuming that the payrolls doesn't show anything particularly negative. And no reason to think it does, because the high frequency leading indicator of note for something like at least the moving average of the non-farm payrolls those weekly jobless claims have been very strong of late. So, yeah, let's see how far this squeeze extends if the mood remains positive, and we'll be back tomorrow with the next Saxo Market Call.
Thanks for listening. This has been the Saxo Market Call. For feedback and questions, reach out to us on Twitter @SaxoMarketCall or by email, marketcall@saxobank.com.